Previously on Falling Low.
This just incredibly loud sound started happening.
And then all of a sudden, boom!
The next thing I know, I'm flying across the table. There is a ball of fire coming.
I just remember coming out of Dad's room and seeing absolutely everything shattered and on the floor. I thought the furnace had exploded.
Okay, what hit? So I just picked up Dad and Herman unlocked the south door, which was how we got out in the porch.
A neighbor, Mary Ellen Moore, had just arrived in her car and said, "Here, put Pete in my car." We did, and I and the girls went with them to the Story City Hospital emergency.
The mysterious explosion that happened on Falling Low Farm on December 9th, 1968, was felt for miles. The closest neighbors arrived at Falling Low Farm first, where the house was already engulfed in flames just moments after the explosion. My Grandma Marie, Grandpa Pete, my mother Sigrid, who was 15, and my Aunt Ingeborg, who was 12, were on their way to the Story City Hospital, which was almost 4 miles from the farm.
We got into Mary Ellen's car, and then she was very rattled, but very with it at the same time, because she went the east way because she said the emergency vehicles are going to be coming and we're just going to lose time. And we're going to be in their way and they're going to be in our way. So we went around then the long way, and she was driving very slow, and she said, "I'm sorry I'm going so slow," but she said, "I don't know how to do this," or something like that. I mean, she was very rattled. And bless her heart, she got us there, and I do not remember arriving at the hospital. I'm sure it took, you know, at least 15, 20 minutes to get there.
The medical staff at Story City Hospital were very familiar with my Grandpa Pete and his frail condition due to his advanced rheumatoid arthritis. They were able to get a private room for him very quickly, which probably wouldn't have happened in a larger urban hospital.
Dr. Semler was away, and so Dr. Hunsinger was filling in. He had long retired. He immediately got Dad and I into a room. Dad and I were laying there, and they had given us each a shot. And I could not open my eyes. I couldn't. And Dad was laying there, and all of a sudden I heard two people in the hall that said, "Two are dead." And I knew they meant Dad and I. And I couldn't open my eyes. And I reached over, and I couldn't. Everything was just so heavy. And I finally said, Dad, they think we're dead. And he said, "No, Tuppy." And I said, "Yeah, they do. They think we're dead. So keep something moving. Move something so they know we're not dead." Because I was just sure we were going to be buried before morning. You know, that was a terrible feeling.
Other than a burn on her hand and some scorched hair, my Grandma Marie was fine, as was my Aunt Ingeborg. This is my double cousin Rebecca reading from my Grandma Marie's account that she wrote for the 25th anniversary of the Falling Low tragedy.
Ingeborg and I were okay, trying to piece together what had happened and where to turn next. After I made sure Pete was comfortable and fairly well settled in his room, I went to find Sigrid.
Here's my Aunt Ingeborg remembering details from that night in the hospital.
I will never forget. Mom, she kind of went from Dad's room to Sigrid's room, back to Dad's room to Sigrid's room, you know, and I'm kind of following around behind and kind of hanging out in the waiting room and stuff. And she finally said, "Oof, I must look a sight." And she went into the little bathroom off the waiting room and came back out and just, "I haven't got a comb. I haven't got my lipstick. I haven't got my purse." And, you know, realizing, you know, she's lost everything. And I don't remember her breaking down then, but just being absolutely, you know, flummoxed. How in the world? How do we function? What do we do?
Meanwhile, my mom, Sigrid, was in her hospital room waiting for the doctor when my grandma came in.
She came to check on me before they stitched me up. And then she told me, "Oh, you look a fright." And yeah, pretty much we all did. And she said, "You've got to comb your hair." And then she went off to find her purse because she said, "Oh, I must have left my purse in the emergency room." And she came back a couple minutes later, and I will never forget the look on her face. She stood in that doorway. For the first time, maybe it hit her.
Here again is my cousin Rebecca reading my grandmother's words.
"It dawned on me, I haven't so much as a comb, a purse, no driver's license, or identification papers. I mean, everything is gone."
We have nothing. And then the nurse just walked her over to the chair and made her sit down. And she said, "Just sit here, Marie." And she sat there for 2 seconds. "I've got to go check Pete." So she was off and running again.
And as I recall, then, you know, it's small town, and the word went out, and we were inundated with combs and compacts and purses and, you know, people just wanting to do anything at all that they could to help. People bringing stuff up to the hospital and dropping it off for the Chernobyls.
My mom, Sigrid, was the closest to the explosion in the northeast corner of the house, where she had been preparing dinner in the kitchen.
My clothes were burnt and very bloody from the cuts. I remember the nurse saying, "We're going to throw these." And I did not have shoes on at the time of the crash. And I don't think Ingeborg had shoes on either, because she had been outside and would have had her boots on. But yeah, we didn't get burned. I mean, through the house, they didn't get burned. In the yard, and with all the metal and the glass and the fire, you know.
The injuries she sustained to her back, scalp, and left arm were caused by the violent explosion and fireball that blew in the window and the wall that was behind her.
I had just shut the oven and turned around and felt like hot casserole. That coil in an electric stove, that's what it felt like on my back. And that's why I thought the oven had blown up.
Right before the explosion, she had closed the oven door and turned around to ask my grandmother where that strange loud noise was coming from. The doctor told her that if she had been facing the window, her injuries would have been much more severe. She would likely have been blinded and suffered severe lacerations to her face.
The back and the back of the head. I mean, I had so much glass in it. The arm was the worst, though. The arm got it good. But I had a lot of poke holes in the back, too. And it was Dr. Hunsinger that kept saying, "I don't understand these 3 and 4 poke holes." And then we figured out, oh, they're forks. When I went over the table, I must have landed and then got these fork holes and...
There were tiny shards of glass embedded in my mom's scalp and back that took months to work its way out. The simple act of brushing her hair became excruciating. She was incredibly fortunate. This was yet another way that God was looking out for my family.
And then I remember getting stitched up and wanting to get up and walk and looking for Dad that night.
Roxy and Becky Holm, their dad was the fire chief. And Monday night was always choir practice. And from what I understand, it went from like 6:30 to 7:30 or something like that. And they just had to call off choir practice because half the choir was in the volunteer fire department. And so they all went. And then Roxy and Becky came up to the hospital after a while to see me and to see what was going on and what had happened and how, you know, we were faring and stuff. Is really, really nice.
Meanwhile, back at the farm, my Uncle Mike, who was 20, and my Uncle Martin, who was 18, were joined by emergency crews as well as many neighbors in the area that poured in to help.
I never went to the hospital. No. Gary Brown came up to me. I didn't have a coat. It's winter, you know. didn't have a coat, and he took off his coat and gave it to me. He said, you wear this, I'll go home and get another one. So I got a big, heavy coat and started walking around where you couldn't walk 5 feet without bumping into somebody. I've never seen so many people in my life, you know? A Rolling Stone concert doesn't have that many people at it, you know? Gee.
My great-uncle Alfred, who was my grandpa Pete's brother, lived half a mile directly east of Fallinglow Farm. Alfred's son, Paul, who was 16 at the time, has vivid memories of what happened that night. Here's our phone call with Paul, who now lives in California.
I think it was around 6, between 6:15, 6:30, right in there. And I was in my room, doing some homework, which is rare. And I heard a jet, which is not a big deal because, you know, we're kind of in the approach pattern for commercial jets flying into Des Moines. The odd thing, it got noticeably louder and louder and louder, and now all of a sudden, boom. It was as if a plane passed right over our house, which it did, and crashed somewhere. Next thing, I heard Mom scream from the kitchen, and I ran out to see what the deal was, and looked out the large window facing the west, and saw the fiery inferno. It was, I'd never seen anything like it. It was, the flames are towering above the tallest trees on the Fallinglow Farm, and my first thoughts were, oh, you know, wow, what happened? Did a bomb get dropped by accident? Underground gas explosion, something like that. But then I remembered the plane and thinking, oh my God, it's been a plane crash.
There were three neighbors who were immediately closest to the farm. Paul and his family, who were half a mile east, and half a mile directly south of Fallinglow, were the Reinertsens. Their son, Gary, who was 16 at the time, remembers that night.
Yeah, we were just sitting down to the supper table, and one of my sisters thought that the man whose farm we lived on was backing his pickup into our house. And then we heard the big boom, you know, so she'd seen apparently the lights coming, you know, towards the house. And yeah, we jumped up pretty quick after that. And Dad and I hopped in my car and we went. So, and when I was going back and thinking about all this stuff, it was so hard because of the fact you found out so much stuff later and you couldn't remember if you knew that at the time or not. I suppose right away you were thinking it was something on the interstate just because the interstate was so close there, you know, and you always thought about the cars smashing together and things. But we pulled up and we stopped on the other side of the gravel road from their house just so, because we knew that there'd be all kinds of traffic coming. And we ran across the road and the family had just gotten out of the house. Of course, you know, we ran to the house first and they said, no, go back, we're fine. And then, boy, then just the house went up so quick just after that. It was amazing. Being 16 years old and pulling up on something like that, I was so shell-shocked. Charlene could have been standing next to me and I wouldn't have known she'd have been there.
Charlene Hovick-Severs, who was my mom's best friend and the same age as my mom, lived across from Fallinglow Farm, just 150 yards east. We sat down with Charlene, Gary, and my mom to talk about what happened that night.
We were just sitting down for dinner, and I thought it was a bomb, actually. And once you realize you haven't been hit, but, you know, we heard windows breaking and stuff, and we ran outside the door when we decided our house wasn't going to cave in, and ran out just into the trees that were to the west of our house. And just seeing your whole place lit up, it seemed like at that point everything was burning. Of course, it was dark because it was December. The house, everything was just going up, and I thought, yeah, I was in hysterics because I thought they'd all died.
Dad, Alfred, was already out the door driving the big LTV, before I even got to the kitchen, he was just gone. And my instincts were to grab the other car and follow him, which I did. Mom didn't want me to leave, but I told her, I got to get over there. I might be able to help, do something. So by the time I get there, I was in a fog. Everything was on fire. Trees, the main house was burning from the outside in. Parked on the gravel road in front of the house, particularly safe distance away. And I noticed pieces of metal, shiny metal with rivets, aircraft metal. And then, it kind of clicked. My first thought said it was a commercial plane, because I don't think about jets that often. You don't see them that often. And thinking, gosh, where are the people? Where are the passengers, the pilots, the big pieces? There were no big pieces. I think I even saw one of the larger hunks that was up towards the interstate bridge had a star on it, a painted star. I knew that made sense then. Military.
What Paul was seeing was the Air Force emblem from a 3-foot section of the fuselage panel from an F-89 Scorpion Air National Guard jet.
My dad and Neil, my brother, ran over there and saw that you guys were okay. And Mary Ellen Moore took you to the hospital. Evidently, she had been coming from somewhere because she was right there already or something.
Well, her husband, Earl, was a pilot.
Okay.
And he heard the plane coming, and he was out of the house before it even hit. And he told Mary Ellen, it can't get out of this. So he knew it was going to crash. So that's when they got in the car, and by the time they were on the gravel road, it had happened. They didn't know where it was going to land, but he said, it can't get out of this.
The terrible noise that was heard that night was the F-89 falling out of the sky at almost 700 miles per hour. The impact and explosion made a 30-foot deep and 30-foot wide crater just east of the corn crib, which was 100 feet east of the Falling Low House.
When I first saw that hole where the jet went in, I looked down in that, and it's little circles of flame all the way down into that terribly deep hole, and then at the bottom it was the big flame, of course. And being a Christian and all like we were back then, and still are, I should say, that was hell. It looked just like hell to me.
The explosion from the airplane was deflected from the house by the corn crib, which was uniquely constructed of concrete and was full of 10,000 bushels of crops, a full year's harvest. If it weren't for the specific placement of the corn crib and where the airplane fell, there's no way anyone in that house would have survived.
I could have been looking down in that hole for 10 seconds or, 20 minutes, and I don't know. People would come and get you and tell you to go do other things, and so we did, but I don't know how long it took between times, and we were there a long, long time that night, so.
With the family being taken care of, they also had to make sure that the animals were okay in the barn, which was just north of the corn crib.
Now, I think the first thing was to go and just spray your barns and stuff. We were spraying water on your barns, just using a garden hose. Because we were afraid the jet fuel was all over those buildings, too. Well, because we were afraid it was all going to go up, We didn't know.
Besides the fire, millions of airplane fragments had scattered for hundreds of yards in every direction from the explosion. Here's my cousin Rebecca reading from my grandma Marie's account.
The National Guard had to call in a snowplow from Ames to clear Interstate 35 about 300 feet from the crash site.
Interstate 35 ran north and south, 100 yards west of the farmhouse.
Many cars going by had flat tires from the debris scattered on the road.
Yeah, the cars were stopping out on 35 there. The people going north because there was so much stuff on the road, you know, and so we were on the highway there and we had to get that off there. We just threw it up onto the grassy areas so people could get by. You know, I did that for a while, and I don't know how long I did that for, and then somebody comes over and says, hey, we need a group you to go out in a cornfield, you know, because we're looking for bodies, and, you know. So we walked over towards the cornfield, and somebody said, get up here, and I got up on the, I suppose it was a fire truck, I don't know, I don't remember. And we went out and was driving around the field, and we only found one, you know, and they thought there would be more. And we, like I say, we didn't know. It was even a air guard jet that went in at that time, so we didn't know how many people we'd find out there. But we found the one.
And then I remember late that evening, once the National Guard were there and were actually starting to investigate, I remember seeing car lights in the field between our house and the farm. And that's where they found one of the pilots. I guess he had tried to parachute, but the chute did not open. And that's where I think they found the canopy close by his body.
The body they found in the field adjacent to Paul's house was the radar observer, First Lieutenant Larry L. Thomas. Captain John Rooks, the pilot, went down with the plane. My Uncle Mike was still at the farm.
I remember being questioned. There's an Army person that came up to me. And he asked, okay, your family is accounted for. I said, yeah. And he said, what would have been between the back door of your house and the barn? And I said, well, the dog. No, we found the dog. What else would have been there? And I said, well, nothing. And he looked at this guy. We found our pilot. And that's all he said.
Dad and I were there inside, well, right in the area for, I don't know. I know it was quite late when we got home. And my sisters and my mom were still up. And I shouldn't probably tell you this one, but like I say, I was really young, you know, and I probably kind of hyped up when we drove back home. So Dad, he said, let's stop by the garage first. So we stopped by our garage, and he went in and got a little bottle of whiskey out of inside the garage there. And he said, boy, don't tell your mother this. He said, but take a couple of drinks. And I took one, and I, whoa, you know, it burned something fierce, and I'd never had that before. I still would never drink straight whiskey, even now. And I took another one, and he gave me some gum to chew, and he had a couple. And then we went in the house, and on the way up, you know, when we were walking into the house, he says, you tell them that, you know, everything's fine, and that's all you tell them. He said, you don't tell them what you saw, you know, and he said, women don't need to hear that stuff, because that's the way it was back then, you know. Women don't need to hear that stuff. So, you know, we really didn't.
Now, the next thing I remember is, I know Michael was in the Falcon with me, headed towards town to the hospital, and I think Martin was with too. And they were obviously in shock, and I was trying to maintain my composure. And I remember Michael saying, slow down, slow down. I was going maybe 25 miles an hour. But poor guy, you know, God, slow down. And he was just in disbelief like we all were. And after that, you know, I really don't remember that much. I remember dropping Michael for sure, possibly Martin, off at the hospital.
I finally got in to see Dad later on that evening.
It was
something.
Late because you came into my room. I had been stitched up.
Yeah.
And you said, did you hear one boom or two? And I said, I don't remember.
Yeah, that seems to be a question that everybody was asking.
Because at one point they thought maybe it exploded in the air and then exploded, you know, when it hit the ground.
The severity of the situation had already reached the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. A nurse told Grandma Marie that a representative from the Pentagon had already called just a few minutes after they arrived at the hospital.
But as I walked by the nurse's station, you know, a nurse had her two cigarettes going, in a hospital, you know, and you walked in and went like this to get the smoke. So, there's the hallway. Okay. Different times, you know. And I remember his name. His Lieutenant General May was in on the phone and just cussing up a blue streak. I do remember that, and then going to see Dad and that kind of stuff. Because he was commander of the National Guard at the time. And I was talking to somebody about, boy, do we have a mess out here in Iowa. You know what I mean? And he had come into the hospital to see how people had done, you know. And I got the impression from him that all he was doing was he was just petrified to the liability this was going to cost, you know, just a few hours. But I guess that's his job. I don't know. You know.
Little did they know that this horrific evening would only be the beginning of a 4-year battle with the government.
I remember at one point, I don't know if it was that night, probably was, Mike and Martin and Herman coming in briefly. And I just kept asking, what does it look like? What does it look like? What does it look like? Everything's gone. They just kept saying, everything's gone. It's all gone. And I could not wrap my head around that. I just could not imagine. And are there posts left? Are there, you know, what does that mean? Everything's gone. How can everything be gone?
Along with the buildings and the belongings that were lost that night on Falling Low Farm was the life of the family's black lab, Buster. But the greatest loss of all were the lives of the pilot, Captain John Rooks, age 28, and the radar observer, First Lieutenant Larry L. Thomas, age 30. Next time on Falling Low.